Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello. Welcome, everybody. I am George Armistead with Alvaro Jaramillo. We are back with Life List, a birding podcast. Alvaro, what's happening, man?
Hey, how you doing? I'm here at home. I've just come back from Toronto, from Canada, and have another week before my first tour in some time begins to Bhutan. So that's
wow.
Yeah. So it's a, I don't know if you get the same thing, George, but before a trip, I start thinking like, gosh, there's so much to see here where I live, like migration's about to kick in and all this. And I almost don't want to leave, weirdly enough. You know, people would think,
yeah,
people would think that, you know, we're raring to go, you know, to these exotic places, and we are, but there's also this loss of like, I won't be able to see, you know, whatever is going to come through here right now, you know, but
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think that's the curse of the birder is you want to be everywhere at once. It's like, you know, it's like dawn whenever, you know, wherever you are at dawn, you want to be like a million places at once. Like what's happening over there? And it's like that, especially when during migration seasons, you're like, what am I missing over there? You know?
I mean, even fantasy birders can only be one place.
That's right.
So like, there you go. It's the curse of the birder.
It's true.
Although the fantasy birder could be real birding in one place and fantasy birding another place. So they kind of are doing too.
But that's true. It's kind of the best of both worlds right there.
Yeah. And yeah. Have we ever dealt with or talked about fantasy birding in detail? Cause that, I don't think me or you do it, but that would be a good, cool thing to sort of, you know, have somebody here who's like a intense fantasy birder and let us know how they interact, you know, with the info, the data. Is it exactly the same feeling as when you're birding by yourself?
I would definitely be curious to hear more about that, because I will say that I have gotten a little, how shall I say this? Every now and then someone will call and be like,
dabbling? Hey, are you dabbling?
I have not dabbled, no, but like every now and then I'll get a message from someone's like, hey, you know, you got a tour coming up to Colombia, right? These are the dates. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, wow. This awesome person wants to come with me to Colombia. And they're like, oh, no, it's just for fantasy birding. And I was like,
I've had that a lot of that too, especially when the pelagic trips are going and it's like, is your schedule out now? Or, you know, where should I put my pin, you know, for your, I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Put your pin, you know, like, but, yeah, I guess what happens is you got to stick to a spot. I don't know what the radius is, and anything that hits that radius goes into your fantasy list. So with pelagics, I think it's key to where you put your spot, you know?
Oh, wow. Because I thought you like sort of, it was like fantasy, you know, football, baseball, whatever. You basically played a birder's e-bird, you know, you played them, you know, and
no.
Okay.
You know, so you're creating like, so you know, hold on. So you, let's say you're doing a fantasy list for your state or like even Philadelphia, right? Mm-hmm. You could pick spots and it's a radius, and anybody who birds that area, all those things go on your fantasy list, I think. So that you are trying to figure out where to put your spot. If it was you there and you're burning that area.
So that's where the strategy come in is selecting your spot.
Selecting your spot. And, you know, you can only select one spot. So should you be at this migratory spot in May versus another one, and what do you need for your list? And, you know, so there's a whole thing going on from what I've gathered, you know, and people have different competitions that they're in. So in the fantasy birding world, like there's a world competition. So then they're keen on somebody who's going to Colombia or Bhutan or whatever. But you cannot be in more than one spot any one time. So, do you want to be in the in the mountains of Bhutan right now versus some other place that might be getting a lot more species, right? You know, it depends what you're going for. It's like,
I don't know. Mountains of Bhutan sounds pretty nice to me.
You know, I know. It's like
high Himalayas, man. You know, Himalayan foothills. Whew, juicy. Yeah.
Yeah. We need to get into this.
I think this would really be a good topic. What's going on. Yeah, yeah. I'd be definitely interested in hearing from some folks on that. If we have some diehard fantasy birders out there, let us know. We would love to dig into this. And we're going to be down the road. We're going to be doing more interviews, more different kinds of pods. You know, so there's going to be a lot more room for exploring different kinds of topics.
Yeah, we're expanding. So, we're having a chicken farmer next week, right? Is that right? So, no? Just wild ones, right?
I don't remember talking about that.
Okay. He's like, you know, no. Yeah. Wild birds.
Yeah. Frank Perdue is coming up. Yeah. No, I don't think so.
No. Mm-hmm. You can't. But if it was red jungle fowl, you know.
Now you're cooking with grease. Pardon the expression.
Yeah. Or chickens running around Kauai with black legs. Countable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's legit. That's crazy. That is legit.
Yeah. I want to see the DNA in those chickens.
I don't know. I don't think you do. I think we're happier
Rhode
this
Island
way.
Rhode Island red there than Polynesian chicken, but hey.
No. I think you don't want to remove the shroud of mystery that exists. Otherwise, yeah. I think we'd all be horribly disappointed when it comes to those chickens.
I want my moa.
Yeah. You want your moa. Nice.
My moa. On my list.
Well, Al, it is April now.
Give me moa. sorry.
I am curious what you've got going in that yard of yours, which you are soon to depart.
Look at me. Looking out in my backyard, there's a golden crown sparrow right now. Ooh. Right now. Golden crowns start looking really good right now. This is when they do a very quick feather change on their heads, and you know, the golden and the black. I've got a lot of white crown sparrows. The hummingbirds have started really sort of moving through. So we have the resident Annas and the Allens have popped in, and I have not yet seen a Rufus, but this is key time for seeing Rufus migrating through. And those are the three I get on the coast. There's no anything else would be like fantastic. Purple, Western purple finches are singing away. They breed around here. So that's kind of interesting. And I get to listen to them do all sorts of weird songs where they imitate birds. So there's some juicy stuff, but the thing that I'm, you know, really, I mean, and we've talked about the yard list, how you know, that I count things seen from my property that are not on my property. Right. You know, some people don't do that. Right. Yeah. But at the end of my street, there's this field that is mostly flooded right now because of all the rain. And there's a big flock of whimbrel that is hanging out in the field, which is unusual. That's only happened a few times in the last, you know, since I've lived here. They're usually on the beach. But right now, that whimbrel flock has three short-billed dowitchers.
Ooh.
And there's a marble godwit. And I think short-billed dowitcher would be a new one for me here on the sort of the yard list. And there's possibilities for other shorebirds to sort of join in there. But I have a few precious days for this to happen before I leave. So it's like, you know, there's a lot going on. And there's so many ducks around because of the water also. You know, like if I had cinnamon teal flyover, boom, that would be a new one. So there's a lot of, you know, should I work or should I sit, you know, on my rooftop or something and watch?
You should sit on your rooftop. There's no question. Sit on your rooftop. Take your butt up there. Get up there. Plant your ass down and get yourself a cinnamon teal. Short-billed dowitchers. They got to be flying around, giving their call note. You ought to pick them up.
I know.
Toot sweet.
I know. There's a lot going on. And the water this year is really shifting things around. I'm kind of interested to see what what people find and if there's either more ducks, more shorebirds, or harder to find because there's more water, you know, like, you know, less concentrated. But yeah, what's going on where you are? What's your backyard doing?
Man, I just got home a couple days ago, and I don't think you can see it, but it's probably just out of view. But my unpacked suitcase is still is still sitting here. So I just got back a couple days ago from Tanzania. Fantastic trip there, and maybe I'll tell you a little bit more about that shortly. But in terms of the backyard, I've only just gotten, you know, a little bit kind of got my feet under me here. Yeah, like I was walking the dog the other day and yesterday, and this mockingbird, which I haven't really heard singing, given full voice, you know, since August or something last year, maybe a little later. It does a great yellow-billed cuckoo, which I've never had in the yard. At least I don't think I've had in the yard. But yeah, at any rate, that'd be a nice bird around here. And every time, you know, it catches me because it's a more penetrating sound than sort of the other mockingbird noises that it's making. The mockingbird's getting me going. But I just had my FOY osprey go over today. There's been evidence of some buteos moving, red shoulders and red tails on the move, which is cool. But yesterday I had arguably my most painful yard bird moment to date, like as a human being, not just for this yard, but I walked, Kristen's actually out of town right now. She, usually the dog is glued to her hip, but, when she's not here, you know, I'll suffice. So he's with me even now, sprawled out on the floor here. And so, you know, I've been trying to get him outside between catching up on work and whatnot. And I walk outside the front door, giving him a little, you know, fresh air. And I walk like 10 steps and I immediately hear like 4 or 5 calls of a sandhill crane, which would be like, whoa. Yeah, like I've had it, I think, just twice before in Philly. But as a yard bird, this would be, you know, like, huge yard bird. It'd be a great yard bird for me. Really good. And I'm like, oh, and
hold
I'm
on a second, George.
Yeah.
How do you separate it from common crane? On voice.
Yeah. Well, I was prepared to forego that as a possibility, but I heard a call like 4 or 5 times, and I was like, oh my god! Like, and I'm literally picking up the phone to alert put it out on the Philadelphia rare bird alert. Before I'm even looking for it, because I'm like, this thing's probably hauling overhead. And I was like, well, I got to look for it, you know? And I look up and I can't find the thing anywhere. And it sounded fairly close. And all of a sudden, like, it just stops calling. And I'm like, oh no. And I look over and there's like a window from a neighbor's yard. And I can kind of hear some other noise from like a television, it sounds like. And I'm like, oh no, did I just hear like the background of a sandhill crane coming from a television show in that house? Or did I actually hear a sandhill crane? And I've been waffling about it because, you know, at this point I don't know. And it just feels like I'm like a child with a balloon that's just floated away and gotten away from me. I'm throwing a little bit of a hissy fit. And if to make matters even worse, today I see my friend Tanya Burnett is birding in Philly down at Heinz Refuge and had none other than a sandhill crane going over.
Oh, then count it. That's it. you got the, you know, what's the chance? Nearly zero that there were multiple sandhill cranes.
It's an increasingly regular migrant. I think I'll probably get one here someday, but maybe never. Maybe I'll have 3 or 4 over the course of my life here at this house. I don't know.
Let's just be logical, though, right? Real logical. Who puts a sandhill crane on TV, like as a background noise even? I don't think I've ever heard a sandhill crane.
I feel like I've definitely heard them on like some movie or another, but I'm not when I looked in the direction that it was coming from, I could see nothing anywhere. And then I noticed this window. And I immediately started walking towards the door. And then I was like, what am I going to say to these? Like, this is a neighbor I don't really know very well. I'm pretty sure our politics don't quite align. So we don't really chit chat a whole lot. But I'm like, I'm walking up to the door. What am I going to say here? Like, what's my, what are you watching?
What are you watching? Yeah. If it's like, yeah, the Price is Right. Oh, it was a sandhill crane. You know, they don't pipe noises, but it was like golf. Oh, could be anything. They could have piped in anything if it was a golf game.
Yeah. I was thinking it was like maybe he's got like some nature special on for his kid or something. But like at this point, the ship has sailed. I'll have to wait for another one, man. But it's been tearing me up. It stings. It's a bitter, bitter, bitter feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least you don't have to deal with the ID issues.
Yeah. Well, until you introduce
all the other cranes. They all sound the same, all the cranes, you know?
Yeah. Well. Oh, man. It was a bummer. It's a real bummer.
Yeah.
But yeah. What are you gonna do? Well, I mean, I can't complain too much. I did just come back from like the Serengeti in the Ngorongoro crater.
Did you see crowned cranes?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we saw a lot of gray crowned cranes. Yeah. No, we saw some amazing stuff. Had a great group of friends. And actually, I'll just give you a quick rundown on some of the stuff we did see.
Like 800 species. Here we go.
Well, 400 some. But, you know, it was definitely like both a mammals and a birding trip. And, but yeah, like we did it. I did get my lifer serval. Serval cat, which was pretty awesome. And it was kind of similar to another lifer cat I got recently that Oncia, which we didn't really talk about. I had down in Colombia. It was like hanging around the grounds of like an establishment. The serval was, and seemed really unbothered by the host of us, you know, birders, nature nerds that were just sitting there gawking at it. It like came out just after dusk and was walking along the trails, like checking under the lights that are along the trail there, looking for like lizards and bugs and maybe rodents come to eat those things. And we just got beautiful views of it. Unfortunately, it's one of those areas where they don't really allow you to walk to your room alone. And I'd left my camera in my tent. And the serval was between me and my tent, so I couldn't easily get back to get there and get some nice photos of it. But, friend Jason Hall was on the trip and he got some nice imagery of the serval. So that was a highlight. We saw in 2 day span, we saw Todd Engstrom, he counted 56 lions that we had in a 2 day span, but we had over 70 for the whole trip. And we did well on cats with leopard and cheetah as well. So those were some cool things. Seeing the mega herd was amazing, right? Like that's kind of like the classic thing in Serengeti. And when we were there in the Ndutu conservation area, that's where most of them were, you know, 360 view, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of wildebeest, zebra, Thompson's gazelle, Grant gazelle, common eland. They're just, you know, literally as far as you could see. And getting to encounter that herd once was a treat. Getting to encounter them a couple times was really, really special. And the first night we were there, I actually took my thermal scope out and found a bush baby, Galago, which was pretty awesome. We got really good views of that. So,
Bush baby,
yeah. They don't call them that anymore. They call them Galagos. And another kind of cool mammal we saw, which you'll get a kick out of, I think, Al. One day we went hunting. I don't want to say we went hunting, but we went with the Hadzabe people. We visited with them, this tribe of folks, which there's very few left. They're just down to a few hundred, I think, now. I think over 1,000 total, but 400 or so living traditionally. And we went out on a morning hunt with them. And they took several, mostly birds. They start their day looking for breakfasts by hunting bow and arrow style for birds. And they took like laughing dove and some blue-naped mouse birds. And then one of them at one point was on something. One of the hunters, he's like, I got something here. And like, you know, it's a click language, so I couldn't understand it. But we had a... we had a translator. His name was Rama. And I was like, Rama, what do they got right here? He's like, it's sort of like a rat or something. And we kind of watched him, and it took like, I want to say 10, 15 minutes. And they're like, it's in the shrub. And all of a sudden they emerge with the thing. I'm like, I don't know how they got this thing, like in this like acacia scrub bush that's super dense. They come out and it's an elephant shrew, which is pretty amazing. I didn't expect to see an elephant shrew at all. But it was pretty amazing. Obviously it was dead. So that was a little bit of a, you know, sort of sad way to see one, but to see one at all was a real treat. They call them Sengi now, S-E-N-G-I, rather than elephant shrews, but it was a Rufus Sengi. So that was pretty cool. And on that same walk, we had a blind snake, a Zambezi blind snake. There'd been big rain, so these things were coming out. So a lot of great mammals, a lot of great birds. Even bumped into our old colleague while there in Indutu. I saw this Jeep approaching, and I was like, that's Terry Stevenson. And flagged him down. I was like, stop, I know that guy. And Terry Stevenson was there leading a field guide's trip, and caught up with him very, very briefly. We were, you know, it was mid-morning. We're, you know, really busy looking for birds, but it was super cool to see him right there at Lake Indutu, surrounded by thousands of flamingos. And we both couldn't have been more shocked to see each other. That was a highlight as well. But
I want to ask, like, these folks go hunting with, aren't you guys just making a bunch of noise and making it like a really awful hunt for them? Or is it, I guess, the payment to head out with sort of the gringos is enough to offset the fact that you just made a great hunt a bad one?
I'm sure we would slow them. You know, they really like impala and baboons. They take larger stuff like that. But they love birds. And as far as the birds go, you know, keeping up with them is tough. I mean, they're fast. They were moving quick. We were just with them for a couple hours in the morning from dawn till about 8 o'clock, 8:30 or something. I don't think we slowed them down for the birds too much, but I don't think they could have gone for any larger fare with us along. Apparently they do eat quite a few birds is one of their main foods. So, you know, with those, I wanted to be like, hey, look, you know, we can actually help you spot some stuff, but, they didn't need much help hitting them there. It was amazing how accurate they were with these bow and arrows. Incredible.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Pretty wild.
Yeah. The serval. I was kind of interested in when you saw the Ancilla.
The old Ancilla.
That's what we call it in America. It's Ancilla.
Uh-huh.
So
Northern Tigrina, if you prefer. Northern Tigrina. The other name.
Tigrina would be Tigrina.
Tigrina. Sí, sí. Sí, habla español. Tigrina. Sí, pero en inglés. Tigrina.
Tigrina. Isn't that Tigrina, the new quarterback? And the
that there, Tigrina.
When you saw that, I looked up, I was like, that thing has such weird patterns on it. It's just so unusual. Like it's really unique looking. And sure enough, they've found now that that population you saw with that more clouded pattern is probably a different species only found in the mountains. And the other Tigrina is, that hasn't been sort of officially separated now genetically, is a different stock of animals. So that's kind of neat.
That was a fascinating paper. I really appreciated you sharing that. It looked like there's maybe even three species. Yeah.
Right.
I think it was like a Central American one. This one that's mostly higher altitude in Colombia and in the Northern Andes. And then, the ones that are more lowland, I think, and widespread, like in Brazil, that are even a little more diurnal. And I think they take more lizards and stuff. It sounded like maybe three species, but yeah, that was a complete shocker on that Colombia trip. Right. Like, I don't think I told you the story on that, but what we...
This is a little cat, in case any, you know, it's kind of like a little version of a kind of a Margay type thing.
Yeah, it's,
you
know, house cat sized. Yeah. Yeah, like a house cat, basically, in size, and maybe slightly larger, but pretty much a house cat. And Leopardus is the genus. And me and Kristen and Hayden were there birding around, and we're sitting there at breakfast, or I guess it was at lunch, and I'm looking it was called the Mirador El Roble, and they on the sign there they had a bunch of birds I see, and they had chestnut wood quail, and I was like, hey, did you guys ever see the chestnut wood quail here? And Powell, who was guiding us that day, she's like, nah, you know, not since the ocelot started coming. And I was like, what the what? And she was like, yeah, she's like, yeah, not since the ocelot started coming. And I was like, I'm guessing that just is really like a nocturnal thing, right? And just as I said that, the dude who lives there comes running around the corner. He's like, come here. He's like, come right away. And we go zipping over, and we can't see anything other than they've got about 8 chickens. And these 8 chickens are all lined up looking in the same direction, giving like alarm calls and scold calls. And you can tell they are not happy. And we're like, there is definitely like a cat, and we could point to where it is, but we can't see it, you know? And I'm like, oh man. But at this point I'm on, you know, we looked for like 10, 15 minutes, waited, saw nothing. And, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Finally, I'm like, okay, I am, you know, like everyone else was still kind of eating. I was like, I'm just going to start walking a little loop around this house here and, you know, just keep my eye out. And on the second loop, I'm going around the hill and I see this tail just like disappearing over the hill. And I'm like, no way. It's like 30 feet away. And I rush up to the edge of the hill, and the thing is sitting there right below me, like 10, 15 feet below me. And it just looks at me like, yes. What, you know, can I do something for you? And I was like, and I'm like trying to like yell to everybody, like whisper yell, you know, like, yeah. I'm like, hey guys, without like alarming the thing, but also trying to get their attention. And the hummingbirds are going crazy. So like Kristen and Hayden are like totally fascinated by the hummingbirds, and they are not paying me any mind. And finally I'm like, all right, screw it. I'm just going to start taking pictures of this thing. I just start taking pictures. And then it kind of sort of slowly walked away. And then luckily Pow, she heard my voice, like, and she got them. They came over, they got it. And then we watched it for like 5-10 minutes. And then people went back and have seen it since there. But yeah, like prior to that, like that was one of those things. I just thought I'd never going to see that thing. I'd only ever heard of it, you know, and read about it in books. It just seemed like a mythical animal. I couldn't believe it, but it was that paper that you sent really helped illuminate and kind of provide a context for it that was really helped. So that was great.
Yeah, that's a wild experience. South America are pretty diverse, and they're not related to the small cats in the old world. Like it's kind of a different. Yeah, I think one of the other things that what was really crazy to see this genetics paper is that cats have hopped from the New World to the Old World 3 times.
Wow!
Like, yeah, because the leopard and the jaguar are essentially the same group, right? So we have these small cats that are a different group. And then the jaguarundi and the puma are related to the cheetah. So you're like, whoa, it's like there's been 3 interactions here between these continents. And, you know, but I got to say, I just get sort of a summary here for people who've been listening to this podcast for a long time. It seems that George likes cats a lot, and his dad likes squirrels a lot. I don't know what goes on in the Armistead family. And theoretically, these guys are birders, but they seem to be more into these specific mammals, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of true. I got to say, like, for me, a wild cat sighting is almost like it's really tough to beat that in terms of like awesome, awesome nature experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to pick a group, man. What, weasels? Should I go for weasels?
You know? Yeah. No, man. I like that idea a lot. Yeah. Those are great. That's one of my favorites, the mustelids. Yeah. We had nice sightings of Tyra while we were down there, you know, which is its closest relative is Wolverine.
Tyra Banks?
I wish, but nay. No Tyra Banks.
Okay. So, yeah. Wolverine. Yeah, Wolverine is one of those coveted creatures. I get to see, you know, I actually could put together a nice list of mustelids, but I do like otters, although they're not always easy to find. But I think I've seen all the New World otters at this point.
Wow.
You know?
You've seen Wolverine. Well, not otters.
Otters.
Sorry, I was thinking mustelids as you were saying that.
Giant otter is the one I've not seen. That's the last one I need to see. But anyway, I have seen a mustelid in my yard, the long-tailed weasel.
Apparently, those things are in pretty serious decline.
Not here. They're not pretty easy to see. Well, not easy to see. If you live here, you'll see them every year a couple of times. But
yeah.
But
yeah, I feel like we've actually talked about mustelids a lot on this podcast because of we've got all seem to have a fascination in them, and Fisher has gotten a lot of time here. That is high on my list of mustelids to get.
Yeah, yeah, and then there's some cool Asian mustelids that I've seen too. But
so yeah, Al, you're going to Bhutan soon.
Bhutan.
Like, what are you going to, what are you after there? And including mustelids.
Well, I mean, I haven't actually studied the book yet, but that's done on the plane. But I have been there a couple of times, and it is the place where I went deaf. If you remember.
Yes, I do remember.
My first trip was cut short. And the first trip was in spring, and then the second trip was in fall. So different, you know, and this is the third trip and it'll be in spring again. So there's a lot of things that I didn't get to see that are migrants, that, you know, will be kind of fun to see. And,
blooming rhododendron is like a big thing there, right? In April.
Yeah. Yeah. Rhododendron forests at this time of year, there's a lot of diversity of rhododendron, and we're going lower than I've ever been to. There's more roads that have sort of opened up, and so we'll be right down at the Indian border. So, you know, that kind of habitat is where, you know, you'll see something, like, silly as it sounds, peacock, you know, like a wild peacock is there. So, you know, I've never seen that other than running around, you know, in my mansion that I have, my summer home, of course, where the big pool and the, you know, and the
big indoor pool.
Yeah. And, you know, all of the
pet tiger.
Yeah. Pet tiger. I have a pet white pet tiger.
You know, nice. So. I haven't seen the white one. No.
Oh, do we still have the yellow one at that point in time when you visited? And you flew in on your private plane. This podcast has been so good for us financially that we do have mansions at this point.
Oh, that were the case, yeah.
I like the people, the way they've incorporated their history, their religion, their natural sort of love for nature, let's put it that way, and into the entire way that the country functions is unique. You know, there are obviously with any nation or people or political construct that we have, there are issues in Bhutan, but for the most part, it's a wonderful place, you know, that is amazing to visit. And different from any other country you've ever been to. And even night and day from their neighbor, Nepal, for example. Very much low density of folks in Bhutan. And there's forest everywhere. And great set of guides and places to visit. So I'm really looking forward to it. And we start in Thailand. So we have a couple of days in Thailand.
Oh, nice.
Before going. So that'll be great for looking at shorebirds and stuff, as well as forest birds. So migratory shorebirds this time of year, and their colors, amazing. Mm.
So, that sounds awesome.
It's going to be fun. But you know what? I don't know. Let's switch this back to something we were talking about the other day of Flacco, right? And Flacco, the owl.
Yeah.
Individual.
Uh-huh.
But here where I live, like very close, I mean, I'm not in San Francisco, but I can be there in half an hour. They have just elected public opinion, the San Francisco official animal, right? So this was broader than just bird. And they elected the parrots of Telegraph Hill.
Oh boy.
The red masked parakeet as the official animal of San Francisco, as the ambassador. Now, there's been a lot of news about San Francisco as a city in decline. I think
this is the high watermark.
This is when you realize you've hit rock bottom. Mm-hmm. I like a parakeet as much as anybody else. Yeah. But I do feel that it's important for symbols that are natural for them to be truly natural, like native to the area. That is, yeah, that matters to me immensely.
I'm with you.
And the fact that, you know, the public doesn't care about that is not their fault, because they haven't had folks sort of give them the nuance of what it means. But also, I thought, like, the runner-up, it wasn't like they were voting between a million different things. I think they only had a couple of choices, three or four.
But who was doing the voting? Was it like a panel, or was it like the public?
I think it was the public, and it was through a local podcast, a San Francisco kind of podcast, something. But the news came out.
We had to take them to task.
San Francisco Chronicle, yeah. But the runner-up, or the other choice, was the California sea lion, mm-hmm, which I think would have been much better because it's native and so forth. I, as a bird, I would have chosen the western gull, not because I like gulls, but it is everywhere in the city. Like, all over, you could always, every day, see the western gull. And I think in terms of history and geography, San Francisco's importance historically was as a port, as a maritime place. Like, you know, the local beer was Anchor Steam, you know, that it's everything about San Francisco originally was the city by the bay, the port, the maritime. And to me, a gull or a sea lion makes sense historically and connects you to the times before. It does a lot as an ambassador. The parrots introduced from Ecuador doesn't do anything for me, except it's
a good book. Maybe The Parents of Telegraph Hill. Nice book.
It highlights the goofiness and crazy quirkiness of San Francisco, and maybe that's a good choice. But then it's all about the people. And it's no longer about the place, in a geographical or natural history context. And that really made me moderately mad. I don't care that much.
I think you've been fighting an uphill battle on the gull. I think, you know, taking the route of the sea lion would be, you know, that to me, that would be a logical one that you might actually get the buy-in. I feel like trying to get a gull through.
I would have gone for the sea lion.
Yeah. Sea lion would have been, you know, and you could tie it in with, you know, all sorts of environmental stuff. And mm-hmm. I don't know. It is a bit of a disgrace. Well, I'm kind of biased against New World parrots anyway. Like, I think there are some exceptions. But, like, I really like. To me, parrots are kind of, they're nice, and they're, you know, there are certain ones I really enjoy seeing in the Americas, but like the Australian parrots are where it's at. That's, they do parrots right down that way. I feel like I'm like, you know, macaws are big and beautiful and all that, but they're really kind of obnoxiously loud and a little overdone. I like some of the little parrots that we see in the neotropics. I love austral parakeet from way down south, South America. But a lot of the Amazonas, I'm kind of like, you know, whatever. You know, they're kind of generic parrots to me.
Yeah, I'd like to see that naked-headed one that was it
vulturine
parrot? It's kind of like, I think I might look at it in the scope and then feel nauseated because it's kind of ugly, but I want to see that,
you know? Kind of wonderfully grotesque.
It's the capuchin bird of parrots, you know, like it's a weird looking creature. I've never been to Australia, so I don't know what to think about their, you know, rosellas.
Yeah, the Rosellas, the Galahs, you know, the cockatoos. Sounds like
something you drink. I don't know. Yeah. But
the black cockatoos, man, those things are amazing. So cool. Yeah.
That is a good question. Like the New World Parrot, which one would you pick as like the really cool ones? I do think the ones I've seen in the Lesser Antilles are different, different critters.
Like the big ones?
Yeah. Yeah,
like the Cicero. What's the Cicero? Is it Dominica or?
The Cicero and the, you know, there's the Vinci. That's the Saint Vincent. Parrot, it's all orange and I'm blanking out on the Imperial Parrot. Imperial Parrot's that's the Cicero. Yeah, and I would love to see that Sun Parakeet. You know, the one that's yellow and orange
in Brazil.
In Brazil. But the one I've seen, and it was years ago back when you could go to Venezuela, you know, easily, was the red fan. Is it red fan parrot? The one, the hawk parrot?
Yeah.
And that thing is weird because
it looks pretty badass. It's
like an accipiter.
Yeah.
I remember flying like a hawk and I'm thinking, what's that? You know, and that was.
I like the really fast, high montane parrots. Some of them are pretty cool.
Some of those, the short, you mean the little short,
well, there's like gray hooded parakeet and, but then also I do like the forpus. They're absurdly cute, the little parrotlets. And I like the, what is it? Halopsida.
There's short tailed things that are
rusty faced and indigo winged. Those are, I really like that. I dig those.
And they're kind of rare. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all kind of rare
sometimes. Yeah. Parrots. But I look forward. Yeah. I look forward to seeing some of the, eventually some of the parrots over there in Australasia when I get there.
That's where they make them right. They make them right over there.
They make them right. Different family, so now they're separated. But oddball stuff, Africa has so few parrots.
Yeah.
It for a tropical region, like you're thinking, like, why did they get spared? They got the famous parrot, like the African gray, but they really have very few parrots and not that amazing looking.
Yeah, they do. We had fishers and black-hooded lovebirds, which are pretty nice. But yeah, in fact, one night on this Tanzania trip, the little room I stayed in had like, I don't know how many. I couldn't tell if it was like four or a dozen fishers lovebirds roosting in the roof of the building. But man, I had to put in earplugs because they were kind of scuffling around and squeaking all night long. That was an unusual, I feel like I'm going to be hearing that call in my sleep for the foreseeable future.
Back to your Serengeti experience. Did they mention at all, like from the population ecology textbooks, the Serengeti is like this example of where the first scientist sort of said, oh, this is how it works. Way back, I want to say like in the 60s, the wildebeest population were not doing all that well. And they realized that there was this disease that was coming through cattle that was holding down the population of the wildebeest. And they vaccinated the cattle or something like that and minimized the disease and the population went up. And then all the lions and everything went up and they got to a limit on the populations based on the predation. And this whole analysis over time, like decades, is where people now talk about bottom up versus top down population regulation. And it comes from those original Serengeti studies. And it's kind of fascinating that a system that is, you would think so complex, if in fact they were able to solve some of the most basic elements of population biology, you know, sort of population ecology, I should say. I don't know if, and all sorts of other things have come from that, like the changes in habitat and, you know, the blah, blah, blah. There's, you know, I'm just like talking off the top of my head. Everything has changed as the creatures have changed and even, you know, shifted the predation and all sorts of things and the trees and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, we did not talk too much about, we talked about the decline in wildebeest in a moderate recovery in numbers of them. But what we did see, and I wonder if it's the same disease. I'm trying to remember it. I was just looking at my phone because I'm pretty sure I made a note about it someplace, but I can't remember what it was offhand. But we saw in one day, we saw, I think it was at least three, maybe four common eland, which had a disease that they got from wildebeest. What happens is it's passed to them from wildebeest. And I can't remember the name of it. It's going to drive me crazy. I'll see if I can dig it up for the show notes. But basically, when the young drop, when the baby wildebeest are born, which happened just a couple weeks before we got there in February, we were there mid-March, and all these baby wildebeest were running around. But what happens is the eland come around, and they, I think it's from the placenta that they like sniff, smell, and catch this disease. And what ends up happening is they kind of go blind. And you see them walking in circles. And it's really sad because you can just see this is going to end bad. And we saw it enough that we became concerned about it, but then it sounds like it's a known thing that happens, to some degree every year at that time of year. And at any rate, I need to do some more research about it, which is why I made a note about it. But I wonder if it's the same thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's different, and this disease I'm talking about was way back in the 60s, and they kind of eradicated it at this point. So the population really rebounded of the wildebeest. So they're way higher now than they were back multiple decades ago. But before we get down a wildebeest hole,
rabbit hole of a wildebeest,
Florida. Things may happen in Florida. And we're not talking Disney and all that.
No. We're staying far away from that. We're talking
birds. Yeah. We're talking birds. Actually, this is the first time we're talking about birds this whole podcast. It seems.
Just about.
Yeah.
I was curious. That was something, as soon as I saw this, I was like, I got to get Alvaro's take on this. Because it popped up on Facebook while I was in Tanzania. And I got a quick look at it, you know. Often on these trips, you've got what, half hour, 20 minutes internet at breakfast and at dinner. And then you're out in the field the whole time and often not much connection. I saw a post from Luis Glace, and I always root for that guy. I love that guy, and saw this Eurasian spoonbill. And I was like, whoa, that's amazing. And I gather there's, some concern that it could be a roseate spoonbill. I still haven't gone to the original eBird list to check out the video or anything. But my initial take was, wow, looks like a Eurasian spoonbill. That is utterly amazing, pretty wild. And I don't know if you saw, then somebody else reported a black cap like a few days later, which I think ended up being clearly shot in like the Netherlands or something. Yeah. That was a clear mistake. It appears
to have been an error. The person was
some
like,
pilot error by the cameraman.
Last week there was a yellow-headed caracara that was posted, yet it had been photographed, I guess, months before or something like that. It was a while ago from Florida as well.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, there's a couple of things about the spoonbill. I think we're going to talk about the vagrancy. I actually have seen a Eurasian spoonbill.
This is part of the reason I asked you is because I immediately went to eBird and started looking at West Indian, records. And I was like, oh, Al's actually seen one of these.
Yeah. St. Lucia. Yeah. And I remember that we were going to go on this Lesser Antilles trip, a field guides trip. And this guy, sent me an email saying we were just there at St. Lucia and there was a spoonbill out there, and roseate spoonbills pretty rare. I think it was like that's how the conversation went. Any spoonbill is pretty rare in St. Lucia, so go and look for it. And I think he has some poor photos, and I looked at it. It's like I think that's a Eurasian spoonbill. So sure enough, we went by the spot. I asked the local, the driver, the guide, it's like, where's this spot? Oh, we're going to drive right by it. And as we're, he's like, here's the spot. I see this big white thing sitting in the field. I'm like, I think that's the spoonbill. So we stopped and we photographed it, and it was a juvenile Eurasian spoonbill sitting there. But the thing back to this Florida bird is like, you know, we all went in there, and I think, you know, see this white photos of a white spoonbill flying around with brown pelicans, and you're like, all right, you know, look at that, you know, and amazing that he got photos using his cell phone and binoculars, like digibinning, you know,
just yeah,
amazing. But on further inspection, I think that is actually a roseate spoonbill.
Yeah, that's that seems to be the consensus that has built, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a really white one, and there is, it's a little, as you can imagine taking a photograph like that, the whites are a little blown out, so you can't see the details, but there's an orangey tone to the sort of wing pits. And also, roseate spoonbills have shorter bills than some of the old world spoonbills. They have sort of a thicker, wider,
used to be different bill. Genus. Yeah.
I think, well, I mean, yeah, well, they were a different, weren't they all?
Well, they're all Platalia now. Yeah. I think they're all Platalia now. But there was, right. Remember, it was Ayaya for a long time.
Right. But was that the only one that was in that genus?
I thought so.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
Could be mistaken on that, but.
You might be right. But it's the only one that's pink, right? They're all, yes. The other ones are all.
We have without question, the best spoonbill. Like, yeah. That's, the, you know, other spoonbills come at us. We've got the best one.
Best spoonbill.
Yeah.
Some of them have good crests, but I think it is not a Eurasian spoonbill. But I did think it was interesting that very few, I mean, you automatically, somebody tells you it's something. It looks right about, you know, it's white looking. We all
black buy the idea
immediately, you know, like it's, our birder brains are not that critical often. And I thought that was an interesting kind of lesson. Like,
I thought so too, because just like, like you say, like initial take was like, whoa, man, that would be amazing. And also like kind of what got us on this track was like, it, given that there's a couple, I'm not sure how many birds, how many individuals have been detected in the Lesser Antilles there in what, Barbados, Guadeloupe, five, Dominica? Or six, maybe? Yeah. Sorry?
Five or six.
Okay.
Five,
so it's, I wasn't sure if it was like one or two or if it was a few more than that. But like, yeah, as you were telling your story about the one you guys saw, both shocking and not so shocking, right? For that location.
Mm-hmm. Right. If it's exactly where you'd expect something like that, or maybe the Eastern Seaboard, you know, like further up, kind of places where you see little egret, you know, you might think some big, you know, Eurasian wader in, you know, not in the sense that they use in Europe and the, you know, big long leg hair or anything. It makes good amount of sense. I mean,
we're kind of at this, we're at the southwest corner, southeast corner of the Caribbean here, basically the part of the Caribbean that is closest to Africa and, you know, pretty snugly just north of South America, and also where the winds hit, right? The winds would carry birds from Europe and from Northwest Africa, which are largely Palearctic birds, to that area. Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah, I was getting confused there. I was thinking about the U.S. that if you're going to see something in the U.S. from the Caribbean, it would be that Eastern Seaboard, you know, kind of situation on the way north. So it made sense, or Florida, of course. So it made sense to have this like bird looking like a migrant coming in from the Caribbean, white, probably rode winds from North Africa to some spot in the Caribbean or even Northern Brazil. Everything kind of made sense, except the fact that it may not be one, but it just all lined up. And I often think about how many birds are missed in the US, given the number of these old world vagrants that are found over time in the Caribbean, Trinidad, Tobago as well, and
Bermuda,
some islands in Brazil. Like if you look at the list of
Martin Bass and
exactly those islands out sort of the, if you think of the northeast part of Brazil, some amazing vagrants, common cuckoos, multiple shorebirds. There are now migratory flock of bar-tailed godwits that sets up every winter, like three or four of them in northern Brazil.
Wow. They're Eurasian ones? They're Eurasian ones.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, Western Europe ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly.
I didn't know that.
So there's all this stuff going on. There's been some really unusual, like, you know, white wagtails and, you know, it goes on. I mean,
whenever I get to the Caribbean of Colombia, I'm always like, there's got to be a rough here. Like, like the Los Flamencos Sanctuary where you and I have been both, I always think there's going to be a rough. I haven't found one.
Yeah. Not yet. I think there's a hoopoe there's hoopoes, right, from the Caribbean.
Well, a couple that I noted, that's one of the ones that's like a mind blower to me. And we actually had a lot of migrating European bee eaters in Tanzania. And I, like, to me, when I think of like Palearctic migrants, I think of Europe, just my own personal experience, European bee eaters and honey buzzards. And like, you know, European bee eaters, you hear them going over in flocks, and there is a record of a European bee eater from Guadeloupe, February 1st, 2014. I'd looked it up on eBird because it's in the historical records for Guadeloupe. And it's photographed in, like, you know, for the folks that don't know, most people probably know bee eaters are a good-looking bunch of birds, but European bee eater is one of the best. And talk about a mind blower. That could potentially, you know, maybe you get one on the Outer Banks in North Carolina or Florida or someplace, like, you know, it would be just a stunner. The other one I liked, Al, was spotted crake, which turned up on Guadeloupe. That was the same time. It was February 2014,
Reason Guadeloupe gets all the good birds is because there's an island just offshore of Guadeloupe called Marie Galante, and there's a bird banding station there and a set of like biologists and birders that go out, a bird research station in any case. And they've found that they found a Pratt and Cole. They found multiple lower end vagrants, you know, shorebirds from Europe, and just crazy. And then Barbados gets a lot of good stuff because it's further east, but it's also, it doesn't have forest, like, you know, it doesn't have a big mountainous forest area. It's a low lying island with a lot of shorebird habitat.
Right. So whatever turns up is apt to be more visible there.
Yeah, I think so. And there's visiting birders from Europe. A lot of UK people go to the beach there, but also some really good local birders that, you know, hit the patch kind of thing. It's interesting. I mean, all of these birds, I remember, boy, it was at further north in, Antigua. Antigua is also an island that has a lot of, not much forest. It's low limestone, a lot of water bird habitat. Just going birding as, oh, there's a black-headed gull. hey, there's little egrets, you know, just finding stuff that seemed, and the little egrets were breeding, eventually confirmed to be breeding there. So it's there's so much of that going on. And so those birds move around. It's like, why don't we find them in the US or Canada, right? They must go north. And I guess they just get lost in the shuffle. They're also probably moving through versus wintering where they're just hanging in, you know?
And of course they get a lot harder when they're not in breeding plumage in terms of the little egrets to pick out from, say, a snowy. They're much easier when they've got their bare parts are you know, and kind of breeding, and they've got their breeding plumes, they'll be a lot easier to identify then. It seems like, you know, almost all the records are like May, June, and then July and August, there's fewer and they occur, but they're harder to pick out once they lose those plumes.
I was, my first trip to Guadeloupe on the tour, there was a marsh harrier somewhere, but it was totally inaccessible. It was in some area you couldn't get to other than with a boat.
There's marsh harrier records, of course, now for, you know, famously the one that just passed after crazily ending up in a jet engine, whatever. But then there's Puerto Rico, I think has two records for Eurasian marsh harrier.
And I don't know if you were there when Doug McRae used to be a tour leader.
We barely didn't overlap. Yeah.
So he used to do the Lesser Antilles trip, and he once with the group, they were driving, and I want to say it was like Montserrat or somewhere, driving in the van, and he says, "What's that thing?" And he's like, "I think that looks like a black kite." And they got out, and there was this black kite flying overhead. And for some reason, only one person got pictures of it. And it was like a roll of film. It was old film, and it got destroyed or something in the airport. There was some reason that picture just never surfaced. So it's not in the official record, but knowing Doug, it was a black kite.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to think of all the possibilities, you know.
Yeah. There. Yeah. I think it would kind of blow some folks' minds. If you like thinking about vagrants, looking at the West Indies, the Lesser Antilles in particular, also Bermuda. Bermuda's got a booted eagle record and some other really wild stuff. If you're thinking about next crazy birds that could show up like Eurasian spoonbill, you know, that's a good place to start looking at sort of reservoirs of vagrancy.
You know, I just saw the other day birder Bruce DeLavio from Canada is doing a Canadian big year.
Oh, is he?
And he went up to Labrador, where I think in the fall there was a Eurasian blackbird that was reported, you know, or the thrush.
Yeah,
and it's still there. It overwintered.
Those things are tough, man.
Still there. And that is one of the few records, I mean, of that species, of, you know, European species there is in North America. And you think it'd be more common,
right?
Given how common they are, you know, in the north.
Yeah.
But we should put together a list of all the goodies that have occurred in the Caribbean. There's been some outstanding stuff.
Yeah.
Many of them never seen in the US or Canada.
Right. And are probably good predictors for things that should be on people's radars in the future.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know how, I don't know if there is a, you know, sort of a birder who out in Bermuda who's kind of a looking for migrants kind of birder or not. It must be, but.
Yeah, there's a good old book on birds of Bermuda by Andrew Dobson and some other stuff. I had a real good day of vagrancy on a cruise ship that maybe I'll detail at some point when we have more time. But it's a real good laboratory for vagrancy. Bermuda is, but
I got a good one that I just posted this the other day. Osprey that
Caribbean osprey.
Osprey is wintering now in Barbados that was banded as a chick in Scotland.
Oh, wow.
So it's got a color band and it made its way across the ocean somehow.
Wow.
And maybe a ship assist, maybe not.
Probably not.
I'm sure that some of these birds can, you know, stop on a ship for a little bit, do a little preening and move on.
Ospreys, we know, they can move if they want.
Right.
Especially a little bit of tailwind gets down to north.
So that's a vagrant in a sense that we know exactly where it came from.
Nest. And one we have talked about, a subject I want to broach further on an episode of crypto vagrants, you know, vagrants that really fly under the wire. Yeah.
Don't invest in crypto vagrants. That's what I've been told.
That's bad news right
there.
They
go up and down in value and there's no controls. Look, kids, don't Don't put your money in crypto, vagrants.
No, it's dangerous stuff. Slippery slope.
But what's a crypto vagrant exactly?
Yeah, like white-throated kingbird, maybe, or you know, various Chaitura swifts from South America.
Right. How many times has a common rose finch been in somebody's yard and they're like, look at that rose finch there.
Yeah. Fly right under the radar.
Yeah, like the ID issues. I was thinking maybe you're thinking about population level, like subspecies or something, but okay, that's a crypto vagrant.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of subspecies. Like I think, you know, I often wonder about these, you know, tropical kingbirds, you know, which ones we're getting.
There was a sooty fox sparrow in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
The other day.
I saw that.
That is a heck of a vagrant.
Like, that's a wild one.
But most people won't get excited because you can't count it on your list. It's still a fox sparrow. But the trip that did is, and how rare it is way higher than a Western tanager, for example.
Oh my God. You know, no comparison.
Way higher. Yeah. It's just a really, really solid, rare bird. If you like rare birds, you shouldn't be discriminating.
Doug Gottfeld posted something. I think it was like the third or fourth east of the Mississippi or something like that.
Ever, right?
Yeah. It's pretty wild. Yeah. No, they do okay up there in New York, picking out some goodies. They get some goodies here and there. You know?
Yeah, they do have a lot of people looking. I wish we had that level of eyes out here. Maybe I don't. Maybe I like going birding to spots.
It's good to have a few mysteries, you know?
Yeah.
Well, man, we are coming up on our time here. I think we got to roll out, Al. But are there anything you want the good people to know about before we close up shop here for the day?
Boy, I've put out my schedule for pelagic trips out of Central California. We are doing Half Moon Bay, Monterey Bay, two in Morro Bay, two in Bodega Bay, and several trips out of Sausalito in the north of the Golden Gate. So a full schedule of trips starting, there's one in May, but most of them are June to October. Pelagics at Alvaro's Adventures. Go to the boat trips pelagic section there. And we posted them just a week ago and already have had a massive amount of interest. So thank you. And it's obvious that people want to get out there and see some birds, whales, jellyfish, whatever we find out there.
A lot of good stuff to see. It's no wonder you're getting a lot of interest. Those are amazing trips, and you guys do a hell of a good job with it. Yeah.
Well, we got to get you out here this season.
Yeah. I know. It's on my brain. I want to get Kristen out there, and she's got some family we could visit. We could come do a boat trip or two with you. Like to catch up with Mr. Brian Sullivan as well and some other friends out that way. It would be a nice trip.
When you guys come out here, I will personally take you to San Francisco to show you our San Francisco animal, the parrot at Telegraph Hill.
I'm not going to go home happy if I don't see those things. So you don't, I'm going to hold you to that. So
eBird is going to give you a big old provisional on that one.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I will keep that in mind. And I would ask folks also to keep in mind, Hillstar Nature, we got one spot left on Uganda. We are going at the end of the year to Uganda. We're going for gorillas. We're going for chimps. We're going for shoebills and all the Albertine Rift endemics we can wrap our arms around. So encourage you to think about that. Also got a couple spots left on two different Columbia trips in July. Those are both gone, but I think we got one or two spots left on a tour. And we also got Southern Portugal with Whitney Lanfranco and Helder Cardoso coming up in October. So think about that as well. Thanks everybody for listening. And thanks to Coa Sporting Optics for sponsoring Life List of Birding Podcast. Alvaro, I hope you have a great day and we will be in touch soon, man.
Yeah, I hope this crane flies over again. That's all I hope for you.
I'm going to get it, man. I'm going to get out there and get it.
See y'all later.
All right. Take care, everybody.